It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I've seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing. I got nothing to do.
It's a sunny day.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care.
Hey, 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 hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
The KSL Greenhouse. Information and great talk about your home, garden, and your lawn. If you love perennials, can't get enough help on landscape design, or just want to keep your lawn and vegetable garden pest-free, grab a pen. It's the KSL Greenhouse on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. I'm Maria Chalaos, along with Ton Bettis, and we'll be taking your calls, 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500. Ton, the sun has popped out here in downtown Salt Lake City, and it is a beautiful day.
It is. Hopefully,
how is it there?
It's still cloudy, and this morning, it looks like the wind quit, but we had a lot of wind this morning, too.
Mm-hmm.
But what usually happens up north happens down here fairly soon, so hopefully we see the sunlight.
The sun is coming your way. You have put together a video on apple tasting. So tell folks about this. This is something you promised you were going to have for us last week.
Yeah, so the apples are something that are very historic as far as how we use them. They've been around for, you know, thousands of years as an edible food. But historically, we didn't just grow apples because they were sweet and juicy mm-hmm. and we could use them in pies. The apples were used and bred for different purposes. You know, back, you know, 300 or 400 years ago, or even 100 years ago, you know, a lot of apples were turned into cider. And the alcohol content of the cider preserved it so that it could be consumed, not just to get drunk. You could, but they actually drank it because it would give you some sustenance if you were producing your own food.
Mm-hmm.
So some apples were bred to be what are called long-keeping apples, and so you wouldn't want to eat them right off the tree. There's one called Arkansas Black that would break your teeth if you tried to eat it off the tree.
Mm.
But if you store it for a couple of months, it softens up a bit and takes on its flavor. And so you'd have these long-keeping apples that you would store through the winter. You know, other apples were earlier blooming in the summer and would be eaten almost immediately. And so apples were something that had multiple purposes and were a staple in a lot of areas of Europe, United States, and Asia to help you through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so this apple tasting we did involved modern varieties and some historic or heirloom varieties. And it was interesting to see what people liked. The apples that were actually rated a little bit down on the list were some of the heirloom varieties that maybe weren't specifically bred for fresh eating. They still tasted good and tasted like an apple, but, you know, they were meant to be used for cider or for storing or other things. So the one that surprised me the most was that the grower, Kent Pine from Pine Farms, who came in and worked with us on this, grows Red Delicious apples, and at some of his markets it's actually quite popular. But what he does, because it has such a bad reputation, is he lets it actually ripen on the tree instead of just picking it when it's red. And when he lets this apple ripen on the tree, it actually is quite a good apple. Because, you know, a lot of times you get these from the store and they've been picked a little prematurely, and so they kind of taste like an apple, but not really. And these Red Delicious apples that Kent had scored well across the board. They weren't people's favorite, but they scored really well as compared to most apples because they were allowed to ripen on the tree.
How many varieties did you
20.
20? Whoa.
Yes. And so you had to be careful.
It's a big taste testing challenge.
Yeah. You had to be careful not to get apple overload, but the apples were fun to taste. There was another one. Of course, Honeycrisp was in blind taste testing. I can't call it scientific, but Honeycrisp was the favorite. And then there were some others that were surprising. There was one called Crunch-A-Bunch that one of our panelists compared to eating a lemon. It was so tart. And other people called it their favorite, but it was just fun to do because people's opinions are so different on what makes a good apple.
Right. You either
but
like a green apple or you don't, right?
You
I mean,
do.
It's just one
yeah.
of those things.
So the Granny Smith is the green tart apple you get in a store, and this Crunch-A-Bunch was even more tart than Granny Smith.
Oh.
So, yeah, the video's up on our Facebook page, and it was just fun to see. And the other purpose of doing this is I had actually recruited a couple of different farms, and I should acknowledge All Red Orchards for donating some apples also to this.
Mm-hmm.
All Reds are in Provo and in Spanish Fork area, and we'll sell at some local markets. You can find their apples. They grow a lot of different varieties that aren't available in stores. And then
oh.
Kent Pine from Pine Farms is in Santaquin, and he grows a lot of apples that can't be found elsewhere. And so because both of them sell at markets and they're local, I wanted to use them as a kind of a representation of the industry that sells at gardeners markets as compared to into grocery stores. And so we do appreciate them donating the apples and should acknowledge them.
All right. And does your video also include a little bit about the historical perspective of each apple? When
not
you...
as much. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I
because
did...
that was so interesting for me. You know, we don't think about these foods. We pass them down from generation to generation, how we use them, but we don't often know how they got their start, right?
Yeah. So I put together a document. Now I'm going to have to see if I can find it, and maybe I'll hyperlink it into the video, and people can look at that. One of the apples, and I'm trying to remember, was it Permain?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one of the apples was the oldest known American variety of apple. It originated from, so Europeans brought apples over from Europe and Asia and planted them, and a lot of them didn't do well in North America. It was too hot and too cold. But these apples that survived okay-ish hybridized with each other and formed new varieties, and just through genetic selection, some of them took. And so we had this apple that's the oldest known American apple variety that it actually didn't taste the greatest, but it was just fun to eat because it's such an old cultivar that's 400 or so years old.
Right. Well, your video is going to be very interesting for those people who are thinking about planting an apple tree and wondering about varieties. And so fun to hear what people think about the taste.
It is. And it's amazing how much the taste varies from apple to apple, especially when you get away from the grocery store varieties.
Okay, so check out the video that is on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page today. We're going to take a break. The number to call, 801-575-8255. We are coming back with your questions. You can also text us your questions at 57500. When we come back, Kevin, you're up next.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Thank you for spending your Saturday with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton answering your questions this morning. 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Ton, this next listener is from West Kaysville. They are really struggling with their clay soil. They've done a number of things to help improve it over the years, including adding mulch occasionally. They say the mulch seems to be good for a year and then disappears, and they still have their clay soil. Recently, they planted over 200 tulips and daffodils in semi-good areas. They tilled in 1 to 2 inches of ute light first, and they want to know, first of all, what you think of ute light. Do they make a mistake, and can they till it into other clay areas in the flower beds and lawn? They say they have, even in their lawn, they have areas that burn every year. Your thoughts?
Ute light's fine as long as you follow the instructions on the package when you purchase it. Mm-hmm. So they have been used in a lot of different situations, and I would go ahead, and that's fine, but just make sure you follow the instructions on the bag. So the
I
other
think
thing,
of ute light more for retaining moisture, not breaking
yes.
up clay.
Well, it can break up clay. It kind of acts like compost, but it's more permanent because it takes a lot longer to break down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can. It's called an expanded clay, where there are different kinds of clays that you can put into small particles or into little, you know, 16th or 8-inch wide little things like Rice Krispies, and then you run them through an oven for just a 15 or 30 seconds that can be 1200, 1500, 2000 degrees, and that particle pops like popcorn and it gets a lot of airspace in it. And then you can use those in a lot of different situations. They can help retain nutrients, they can open up a soil a little bit and create some drainage and airspace. And so it's not as commonly done here, but these expanded clays are used in clay soils to help do just exactly that, to help break them up a bit, create some drainage and some airspace in them.
So they didn't make a mistake. Can they use that in their lawn?
They could, but it's harder to get into the lawn. They'd have to aerate and then try to put it down.
Mm-hmm.
So
that would be a lot of
the
work.
One thing I wanted to mention on their compost is that compost isn't a once and done process because it breaks down. And so if you have clay soil, you have to consistently put compost in because it will disappear after about a year. So in that clay soil, they would need to put 2 to 3 inches of compost and work it into the soil every year until they're kind of happy with what they get, because they're putting excess compost in to do more. Once they get happy with what they've got as far as their soil, 1 inch a year will maintain it.
Okay, next listener has a problem. This is Bob. He's having a problem with his potatoes. He says they're brownish gray, speckled ring, like 1/8 to 1/4 inch just below the skin, and overall blotchy, mealy looking flesh. And he's wondering if you have any ideas.
Yeah, I think that with a limited description, it's a disease called zebra chip.
Ooh.
It's caused by a bacterium that's spread by a little insect called a psyllid. And the zebra chip doesn't show up in the foliage, above ground. And a lot of times you don't even see it in the potatoes themselves until you cut them up and cook them.
Okay, so does that impact the nutrition or the flavor of the potatoes?
As far as eating them, I think that they're off-flavored. But it has shown up over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years in Utah where it wasn't here before, and it's a problem. And so I think in the future when they grow potatoes that they'll need to look up, management and zebra chip disease on a fact sheet. I actually texted them a page about it already.
Perfect.
So that they know how to control those psyllids so they don't get it next year.
Terrific. Next person wants to know if their irises should be divided now if they didn't get to it, or should they wait until spring?
Wait, even if they would have been at the, mid-September, early October, they would have been okay. But at this point, they need time to reestablish once you break them apart. And so I would just wait until July or August of next year.
Okay. Next person wants to know if they can still prune their spirea.
Spirea, I know. Put the pruners away. Unless you have to. Now, I sit here and I kind of, get it carried away with fall pruning. And I should say, when I was in college, you're a starving student, I did landscape maintenance for one of the major home companies as kind of a side gig. And they wanted their model homes cleaned up in the fall. So through September, October into November, we would clean up anywhere from 6 to 10 or 12 model homes, anywhere from North Ogden into Farmington. And, you know, when I sit here and preach against fall pruning, they had happened to use a shrub mix that was pretty durable. And we pruned spireas and we pruned privets and cestina plums and a number of other things that were common. And in general, the plant survived fine. Now, the exception here is that the company purposely used shrubs that were more tolerant, not intentionally, but they did. And so if you went out and started pruning, say, on a peach tree right now, and we go from 60 down to 5 degrees, which we very well could, everywhere you pruned is going to be heavily damaged and it may harm the tree. And even when we have temperature drops like that on more tolerant trees and shrubs, you can still get damage. So if you can wait, you really should.
Okay. A next person, speaking of trees, says that their neighbor's tree has big limbs. And yes, they are growing over their fence and onto their property. And they're responsible to remove them, right? But during the windstorm, they said they were both worried about it, that they would fall on his house. And so they removed the limbs, but they say that the wife was mad about that. But that was their right, right? If it's going over their property, they can remove those limbs.
Yes, as far as I know, they may need to consult an attorney experienced in property law. Mm. But my understanding, and this is, again, the big caveat, I'm not an attorney, is when those branches grow over the fence into your yard, you have the right to cut them at the property line.
Okay, so that doesn't mean you can go into their yard and cut the branch from the...
No,
okay,
you may
so
not.
That is really, I think,
that's
the clincher
here. That's trespassing, and you could be liable for that. All you can do is trim them at the property line, but you would need to get a hold of an attorney experienced in real estate and property issues to make sure, because there's a lot of subtleties to these laws.
Okay. Next person wants to know a little bit more about feeding winter gardening additions, and they're talking about like African violets. How do you feed those?
Winter, you don't feed them as much.
Okay.
And what I would recommend doing is getting an African violet fact sheet, because growing those are a hobby in and of themselves. In and of itself, it's a hobby. But in those, you may need to give like a third strength or a half strength plant food to every, you know, couple of weeks or month, because they bloom. And because they're blooming and putting energy into that, they're going to need to be able to restore it. But otherwise, you don't generally fertilize houseplants in the winter. They're not that they're dormant, but the lower light levels and the cooler temperatures causes them to not grow so much. And so they survive, but they won't really start growing again and trying to put on that new growth until February and March. And that's about the time that you can use half-strength plant fertilizer or a granular fertilizer meant for that.
This person is definitely a hobbyist. I can't get African violets to grow. My mother-in-law could get African violets to grow. I mean, the plant lasts for just a little bit of time and I'd be done. So I'm obviously not putting them in the right location. But this person even does the paper whites, which I had a real hard time with as well.
The paper whites can be fun, but they are stanky little things.
Okay.
Smell like roadkill.
That is a terrible thing to say on the Greenhouse Show.
Well, they are
very,
very pretty. They are. But you just...
I'm giving you a hard time. They are smelling, no doubt about it.
To have this wonderful scent coming off a flower and you go get this roadkill, and it's not super strong, so it's not going to stink up your house.
No.
But when you smell them, they can be a little off-putting, but they are gorgeous flowers.
They are beautiful. We need to take a break for the bottom of the hour news, 801-575-8255, and you can text us at 57500. Love those stinky subjects.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.